This evening, we're continuing our overview of the Old Testament book titled Job. With this as the focus, if you would, let's open our Bibles to Job chapter 41. And as you make your way to the 41st chapter of Job, I just want to take some time to put our text back into its context. It'll first help us to remember that the bulk of this book is centered around the dialogue that took place as Job and his friends shared their personal opinions and perspectives about the purpose of pain and suffering that the Lord allows us to experience. And after three rounds of dialogue and debate, the voices of those men were suddenly silenced as the Lord began to speak to them from the midst of a whirlwind. And it was at that point in time when the Lord launched into a series of questions which were designed to humble those who had darkened counsel by words without knowledge. I'll remind you, it was in our study 3 weeks ago when we considered the first slate of questions that the Lord presented to Job. This included a list of questions about the way our Creator created the cosmos. He asked Job about the foundations of the earth as well as the land-based boundaries of our oceans. He asked Job to explain the clockwork of our solar system, as well as about the stars that create the constellations we see in the skies. And in this way, the Lord was simply helping Job to realize that he wasn't the all-knowing wise one that he thought he was. In order to further make his case, the Lord went on to present Job with more questions about the animal kingdom. And it was in our study 2 weeks ago when we considered the way that our Creator created the critters that he placed here on this earth, which were all designed according to their own kind. And after presenting Job with a litany of questions about the natural order of the animal kingdom, well, I have no doubt that Job was beginning to realize that his complaints against our Creator were based on the ignorance of foolish pride. Then in our study last week, the Lord continued to make his point as he directed Job's attention to a beast that he called Behemoth. And as the Lord described the way that he designed this incredible creature called Behemoth, he was actually helping Job to realize that Job was complaining about the plans and the purposes of this almighty creator who created the dinosaurs that once roamed this earth. And in this way, the Lord was once again helping Job to simply humble himself before our almighty creator. Well, now here in our text tonight, we find the Lord continuing to make his point, and he does this by directing Job's attention to yet another incredible creature that God designed. Now, with this as the focus, if you would, let's turn our attention to Job chapter 41. I'd like you to look with me here, beginning at verse 1. Here the Lord asks, "Can you draw out Leviathan with a hook, or snare his tongue with a line which you lower? Can you put a reed through his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook?" Now here in the beginning of this chapter, we find the Lord, he's asking Job if he's able to capture this creature that he calls Leviathan. Now that word Leviathan was translated from a Hebrew word, which can be rendered sea monster. It can also be rendered dragon. And much like Behemoth found in the last chapter, there are some scholars who are just quick to insist that Leviathan is nothing more than a mythical creature. And so we shouldn't take this chapter literally. There are also others who would have us to believe that the Lord was speaking about a real creature, and some say that it may have been a crocodile, others say it's possibly a whale. And while I can appreciate their desire to take the Bible seriously, I must also insist that the description of this creature called Leviathan, well, it sounds to me much more like a dinosaur, which would actually fit the description of a fire-breathing dinosaur, or what we might call a fire-breathing dragon. Now, before you dismiss fire-breathing dragons as being nothing more than a fairy tale or a mythical creature, I want to take a moment to remind you that it was back in chapters 38 and 39, that's where the Lord directs Job's attention to several animals within the animal kingdom, including lions and donkeys and mountains and oxen and horse and deer. And he also mentions ostriches and ravens and hawks and eagles, all of which are critters that we find here in the natural world. And then in chapter 40, the Lord directed Job's attention to Behemoth, which when we considered the description, it seems to be a reference to a giant dinosaur, which we more commonly call a brachiosaur. And it was in our study last week as we considered some convincing evidence that there were actually dinosaurs like brachiosaurs that walked the earth during the days of Job. But regardless of whether the brachiosaur walked the earth during the days of Job or not, brachiosaurs are real creatures. They're real critters. And so again, the Lord wasn't referring to a mythical creature in Job chapter 40, but a very real creature. Well, now, here in our text tonight, we're going to consider yet another creature that the Lord calls Leviathan. And listen, if all of the creatures leading up to this point were real creatures living in the animal kingdom, well, then why would the Lord all of a sudden shift gears and start talking about some mythical creature? It wouldn't make any sense. If all the creatures that the Lord has mentioned so far literally belong to the animal kingdom here on the earth, well, then it only stands to reason that this fire-breathing beast found here in our text tonight was also a critter that the Lord created to dwell here on this earth. Well, with all this in focus, let's take a closer look at this massive monster that the Lord calls Leviathan. If you would look with me again, beginning at verse 1, here the Lord asks Job, "Can you draw out Leviathan with a hook or snare his tongue with a line which you lower? Can you put a reed through his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook?" Now, as we consider these questions again here, there should be no doubt in our minds that the Lord was asking Job about this creature that Job would have been familiar with. You know, he's not asking Job about a creature that he was unfamiliar with. He's saying, hey, you know about this beast. You know about Leviathan. Can you capture him? Can you hook him with a snare? Now, some are convinced that this was a crocodile, and yet I have a hard time believing that the people during the days of Job were like struggling to capture crocodiles. You know, I just have a hard time thinking in that way. And proof of my point can be found in the multitude of mummified crocodiles that have been found within the tombs of the ancient Egyptians dating as far back as the 5th century BC. For example, 10 crocodile mummies, including 5 more or less complete bodies with their 5 heads, were found in an undisturbed tomb in Aswan, Egypt. And that's just one example. As a matter of fact, the mummified remains of crocodiles are so common in Egypt that many museums are just stacked full of them. They've got mummified crocodiles, you know, in all of their closets, so to speak. That being the case, the Lord's question to Job here, you know, about, hey, can you do this? Can you capture a crocodile with a hook? I mean, Job would be like, yeah, I just did. You know, I've got a dead crocodile in the backyard right now. No, the Lord's question would make no sense if, you know, if it was common for people to capture crocodiles, which it was. Crocodiles were easily caught with hooks and snares there in ancient Egypt, and probably just as true in the land of Uz. And further proof of my point can be found in the compelling program. Maybe you've seen it. It's called Swamp People. I love it. Swamp People is incredible. If you're unfamiliar with Swamp People, this show, it documents the dangerous job of alligator culling in the swamplands of southern Louisiana. It's a delightful show. And listen, I don't mean to suggest that this is an easy job. It's not an easy job. And yet, listen, if Tom Landry and Willie Edwards are able to draw alligators out of the swamp with a treble hook, I'm guessing it was a no-brainer for Job as well. I can assure you that Job and the people in his time period were able to easily capture crocodiles. And so clearly, Leviathan was not a crocodile. Well, in order to narrow that down, the identity of this beast, I want to continue to consider the questions that the Lord presents to Job here. If you would look with me there at Job chapter 41, we'll pick up at verse 3. Here the Lord asks, "Will he make many supplications to you? Will he speak softly to you? Will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him as a servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird? Or will you leash him for your maidens? Will your companions make a banquet of him? Will they apportion him among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears?" Now here in these verses, we find the Lord, he's presenting Job with 8 more questions about Leviathan. And as we take a closer look at these rhetorical questions, we find some details here that might help us to better understand what sort of creature this was. For example, when the Lord asks if he was able to play with Leviathan as he would play with a bird, well, I can't help but to wonder, was this some sort of flying creature? Was Leviathan able to fly like the birds? We can't say for sure, but the question certainly seems to suggest some sort of comparison to the birds. And maybe Leviathan was like a dinosaur with wings and feathers, you know, like Archaeopteryx, that they once thought was some sort of transitional form until they realized it's not. There's no transitional forms. Archaeopteryx was just a dinosaur with wings and feathers. And so it's possible that Leviathan was kind of like Archaeopteryx. At the same time, the Lord also asks Job if he was able to pierce his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears. And this reference to harpoons and fishing spears, it seems to suggest that Leviathan was some sort of large aquatic animal. And it's for this reason that some believe that the Lord may have been referring to a plesiosaur, which is a large carnivorous reptile which lives in the deepest depths of the oceans. Now, many scientists will insist that these critters are extinct, the plesiosaurs. Others believe that they still exist. Some even insist that the Loch Ness Monster is more than likely a plesiosaur. That we don't know for sure because the Loch Ness Monster has yet to be caught. Or even seen in a real photograph that's not blurry. But maybe the Loch Ness Monster is just blurry. And maybe that's the case. We don't know. But regardless of whether the Loch Ness Monster is a plesiosaur or not, you know, it's not entirely impossible to imagine that plesiosaurs still exist in the deepest depths of the oceans. You know, the oceans are largely unexplored, and who knows what's down there? I don't want to find out. But listen, many scientists insist that these critters, you know, they're extinct. Others think that they're not. But listen, some believe that a carcass of a plesiosaur was pulled up in the net of a Japanese fishing ship back in 1977. This photo here of a 4,000-pound carcass certainly looks like it could have been a plesiosaur, while others insist that it was actually just the carcass of a basking shark, I should say. Now, according to the reports, you know, tissue samples were taken. They didn't want to, you know, haul 4,000 pounds of rotting flesh, you know, all the way back to Japan. And so they dumped it overboard. But they did take tissue samples from this carcass that were then studied by a team of Japanese scientists. And those scientists at the Science Museum of Tokyo, they unanimously declared that the creature was, in fact, a plesiosaur. And it wasn't long before they did what everybody would do, which is to make a commemorative stamp, including the image of a dead plesiosaur. Well, it didn't take long before the French ruined everything, and this group of French researchers got involved, and within a year, a new report assured the world that it wasn't a plesiosaur, it was the carcass of a large basking shark. And this despite the fact that the photos don't look like any shark that I've ever seen. And so with that, I guess the verdict's still out of whether that was actually a plesiosaur or not. We're not going to solve it here tonight, but regardless of whether they pulled up a plesiosaur or not, whether a plesiosaur still exists in our oceans or not, listen, I have a hard time believing that Leviathan was simply a plesiosaur. And at the same time, we can still be sure that the creature found here in our text tonight was some sort of beast that actually existed and during the days of Job. In order to further make my case, let's consider the warning that the Lord then goes on to present to Job here in our text tonight. I want to pick up our study of Job chapter 41. We'll begin reading at verse 8. Here the Lord declares, "Lay your hand on him, remember the battle, never do it again. Indeed, any hope of overcoming him is false. Shall one not be overwhelmed at the sight of him? No one is so fierce that he would dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand against me? Who has preceded me that I should pay him? Everything under heaven is mine." Now here in these verses, we find the Lord, he's encouraging Job to realize that those who try to overcome Leviathan will never forget the battle. If you try to fight Leviathan, you will not forget that battle. And the reason why is due to the fact that this was such a massive monster that even the sight of Leviathan was overwhelming to the viewer. Then with this incredible creature in mind, the Lord goes on to ask, "Who then is able to stand against me?" Here's the point of application. He's saying, hey, look at this beast Leviathan, and now ask yourself, if you're afraid of that, are you forgetting I created that? And if I'm the creator of Leviathan and you fear Leviathan, should you not much more fear me? If the very sight of a beast like Leviathan strikes fear into the hearts of humans, how much more should we then humble ourselves in the sight of Leviathan's creator? King Solomon put it best in Proverbs chapter 9. It's verse 10 where he declares, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding." Christian, listen. The wisest people in the world are those who are quick to realize that it's a fool's errand to stand in opposition to our Creator. It's a fool's errand to stand in opposition of our Creator. And it's for this reason that we should then humble ourselves in the sight of our Creator by revering Him with respectful fear. I don't think that God wants us to be afraid of Him, but we should most certainly revere Him with respectful fear. And this is the point that the Lord is continuing to make as he continues to direct Job's attention to Leviathan. And with this as the focus, let's pick up our study of Job chapter 41. I want to draw your attention beginning at verse 12. Here the Lord declares, "I will not conceal his limbs, his mighty power, or his graceful proportions. Who can remove his outer coat? Who can approach him with a double bridle? Who can open the doors of his face with his terrible teeth all around? His rows of scales are his pride, shut up tightly as with a seal. One is so near another that no air can come between them. They are joined one to another. They stick together and cannot be parted." Now, here in these verses, we find the Lord describing the incredible power of this massive monster. And as we consider his terrible teeth, no doubt Leviathan needed an orthodontist. But no, that's not what that means. He had terrible teeth. In other words, you know, his face was filled with these massive teeth and then scales that were shut up so tightly that they were sealed. And so there should be no doubt that the Lord was describing what I believe to be as some sort of reptile. To make my case, it'll help you to know that there are many different kinds of critters that have scales. As a matter of fact, not only reptiles have scales, but there are also fish and birds, mammals and arthropods that have scales. At the same time, though, the scales that are found on these different creatures aren't exactly the same. Some are more like lots of fingernails and these sorts of things. There's different kinds of scales. And as we consider the way that the scales of Leviathan were shut up tightly as with a seal and joined to one another so that no air could come between them, this leads me to think that this was some sort of reptile. Leviathan was probably a reptile that lived on land as well as in the water, much like a crocodile. At the same time, I can assure you, this was no crocodile. And to prove my point, let's continue to consider the Lord's description here. I want to pick up our study of Job 41, beginning at verse 18. Here the Lord declares, "His sneezings flash forth light, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning lights, sparks of fire shoot out, smoke goes out of his nostrils as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals, and a flame goes out of his mouth." How incredible is that? The Lord here is describing Leviathan as this creature that has the ability to breathe fire. And while some might insist that this is nothing more than a mythical creature, listen, there are others who insist that fire-breathing dragons once existed here on the earth. For example, there was a 3rd century historian named Philostratus who recorded the life of Apollonius of Tyana. And according to the testimony of Apollonius, the whole of India was surrounded during his days with dragons of enormous size. He also confessed that the marshes were full of them and the mountains as well, and there's not a single ridge without one. Apollonius also informs us that the crested dragons, and I quote him here, "they give off a noise like the clashing of brass whenever they are burrowing under the earth, and from their crests, which are all fiery red, there flashes a fire brighter than a torch." Incredible to consider how here's this historian describing India as a place that was full of fire-breathing dragons. Alexander the Great also confirmed the claims of Apollonius. As a matter of fact, it was after his invasion of India when he brought back reports of seeing great hissing dragon living inside of a cave. The 1st century Greek historian Strabo, who traveled throughout the Mediterranean and Near East, he confirms this as well. It's in his paper on geography where Strabo describes India as a place where, and I quote him here, there are reptiles 2 cubits long with membranous wings like bats, and that they too fly by night, discharging drops of urine or also of sweat, which putrefy the skin of anyone who is not on his guard. That just sounds like a horrible place to live. Marco Polo also wrote about huge serpents in China by declaring this, and I quote, "The jaws are wide enough to swallow a man. The teeth are large and sharp, and their whole appearance is so formidable that neither man nor any kind of animal can approach them without terror." Now, I'm guessing when Marco Polo saw those creatures, he probably felt like a fish out of water, but maybe not. Listen, this is just a scratch on the surface of all of the ancient historians who have confirmed the stories of massive fire-breathing dragons existing here on the planet. And it's also interesting to note that we find our artistic accounts of dragons in every single civilization. This includes many ancient artistic depictions of dragons from the people of China. For example, an ancient Chinese ornamental box included a display of a long-necked dragon, which has a compelling likeness to a brachiosaur. And it was 4,000 years ago when the Hongshan culture in China produced many wonderful jade dragon carvings, which look just like dinosaurs. We find illustrations of dragons in ancient Rome. We also find a story about a dragon in the country of Georgia, which is not to be confused with Georgia here. But it was there in Georgia where they have this story of a bell tower window of the Holy Church. I'm mixing this up. So there's the story about the dragon there in Georgia, but there's also a bell tower window of the Holy Trinity Church, which includes an ancient icon of Saint George slaying a snake-like dragon. Now, there's actually many reliefs and illustrations of similar scenes, including the 15th century work known as the Latin Book of Hours. And the famous Italian artist Leonardo da Vinci, he created works of art that depict cats and lions, as well as dragons. Some of the beautiful French chateaus built at the close of the Middle Ages have dramatic dragon illustrations carved into their walls and ceilings and furniture. And many of these depictions of dragons actually resemble dinosaurs whose fossils have been found in multiple locations all throughout Europe. And with all this in mind, it'll interest you to know that there are, in fact, dinosaurs, and we find the remains, you know, we find the fossils of dinosaur skulls that have hollow crests, or hollow crests. I'm getting confused with the app. But they have hollow crests in their craniums. These dinosaurs, which include T-Rex, also had connected nasal passages to these hollow cranium domes, which are entirely unrelated to their sense of smell. So imagine you've got, you know, this hollow space in your head, which it's not hard for many of us to imagine that. But then tubes that could connect to the nostrils, as well as back down the back and into the stomach area where gases, natural methane gases, would collect. So imagine if these dinosaurs were able to collect methane gas from the stomach into the hollow crest of the cranium, and if then they're able to produce a chemical reaction, sort of like a lightning bug or a bombardier beetle, well, then it would be easy to think that these dinosaurs could actually produce fire from their nostrils. And so there's good evidence, you know, in the fossil record that this is, at the very least, a possibility. What this means, then, is that it's not unreasonable for us to imagine the existence of fire-breathing dinosaurs. You know, just think about electric eels and the charge that they're able to produce. Bombardier beetles that mix chemicals, you know, in some sort of way that I don't understand, but they can cause explosions and lightning bugs and these sorts of things. So it's not unreasonable to think that this was actually a creature that God designed. And as we consider the many historical accounts of fire-breathing dragons and the fossil record, which shows us these dinosaurs with these hollow domes in their craniums, it shows that, at the very least, it's a possibility. And When we factor in then the Lord's description of Leviathan, well, God's not going to lie to us. God's not going to mislead us with misinformation. I mean, he's not running CNN, right? So we can trust his word. And so it seems to me that these frightening creatures actually existed and during the days of Job. Now, with all this in mind, I want to continue to consider the description that the Lord presents to Job here. Let's pick up our study of Job chapter 41. We'll begin reading at verse 22. Here the Lord declares, "Strength dwells in his neck, and sorrow dances before him. The folds of his flesh are joined together. They are firm on him and cannot be moved. His heart is as hard as stone, even as hard as the lower millstone. When he raises himself up, the mighty are afraid. Because of his crashings, they are beside themselves. Though the sword reaches him, it cannot avail, nor does spear, dart, or javelin. He regards iron as straw and bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones become like stubble to him. Darts are regarded as straw. He laughs at the threat of javelins. His undersides are like sharp potsherds. He spreads pointed marks in the mire." Now here in these verses, we find the Lord, he's describing the great difficulty of killing these creatures. He's describing the great difficulty of killing a fire-breathing dragon. And it's not only difficult to pierce through the flesh of these massive beasts, but it was almost impossible to pierce through to the heart. Therefore, even the most valiant men were filled with fear whenever they found themselves face to face with a leviathan. It's for this reason that the bravest men actually worked together in order to hunt down these dinosaurs. Because listen, if you had a big lizard living in your backyard, what would you do? You're going to try to get rid of that as soon as possible, right? And so Apollonius even describes the way that men would gather together in order to go hunt down these dragons. And according to the 3rd century account of Philostratus, the hunt for dragons was a chase, which was, and I quote him here, "as bold as it was wonderful." Wow. What are you doing this weekend? We're going to go hunt dragons, and it's going to be wonderful. That's how I imagine that conversation going. But listen, I want to consider the conclusion that the Lord goes on to present here in Job chapter 41. If you would look with me at verse 31, here he informs Job that Leviathan makes the deep boil like a pot. He makes the sea like a pot of ointment. He leaves a shining wake behind him. One would think the deep had white hair. On the earth, there is nothing like him, which is made without fear. He beholds every high thing. He is king over all the children of pride. Now, here in the final verses of this chapter, we find the Lord, he's wrapping up this description of Leviathan by describing him as the most fearful creature that the Lord created and placed here on the planet. And seeing how Leviathan was more fearful than every other creature on the earth, the Lord then informed Job that Leviathan is the king over all the children of pride. Imagine being a Leviathan, being at the top of every food chain, and just feeling that pride of, no one's going to bring me down. And as we consider the way that God describes Leviathan as the king over all the children of pride, it's a very interesting statement because the Lord seems to be suggesting here that those who would dare resist the creator of Leviathan will be delivered into the claws of Leviathan. And I like the way the scholars who created the Amplified Bible render verse 34. Here's how they put it. "He looks on everything that is high without terror. He is monarch over all the sons of pride." And then they amplify this with this parenthetical statement. "And now, Job, who are you who does not dare to disturb the beast, yet who dares resist me, the beast's creator? Everything under the heavens is mine. Therefore, who can have a claim against God?" Here in this parenthetical amplification of verse 34, the scholars who created the Amplified Bible, they tie this verse back to the challenge that the Lord presented back in verses 10 and 11. And with that, I want to back up and take another look back at Job 41, 10 and 11, There the Lord declares this. He says, no one is so fierce that he would dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand against me? Who has preceded me that I should pay him? Everything under heaven is mine. In other words, if Job was cautious to avoid arousing the anger of Leviathan, how much more cautious should he have been before speaking forth words that darken counsel with words that are without knowledge? If he was cautious around a Leviathan, how much more cautious should he have been in speaking against the one who created Leviathan? With this question in mind, we should take a moment to consider one more possible interpretation of this final verse, because it actually seems to be a warning about a supernatural dragon commonly called the devil. I believe that the whole chapter is about, you know, Leviathans, which were literal dragons. But I think that in this final statement, God may be shifting Job's perspective to a supernatural dragon known as the devil. Notice again at the end of verse 34, the Lord declares, he beholds every high thing. He is king over all the children of pride. As we take another look at this verse and as we consider how this fire-breathing dragon is king over all the children of pride, can't help but to wonder if the Lord was shifting Job's attention from Leviathan to Satan. With this question in mind, I want to take a moment to consider how the Apostle John describes Satan as a great dragon. It's in Revelation chapter 12, in verse 9, John describes the day when the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. From this, we can see here that Satan is not only called the devil, but he's also referred to as the great dragon. He's also known as the serpent. And much like Leviathan, the great dragon, better known as Satan, is the king over all the children of pride. I believe that Satan is the king over the children of pride. And with this in mind, it's important for us to remember that it was back in the beginning of this book when Satan came before the Lord and asked for permission to put Job's faith to the test. And so we find Satan at the beginning of this book, coming before the Lord and asking to test the faith of Job. But now we find Leviathan in the final section of this book as the Lord is directing the attention of Job to the great dragon. That being the case, it's possible, if not even probable, that the Lord was concluding his homily to Job by presenting a warning about the way that pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. It's as if God is saying, hey, remember, it was pride that caused the great dragon to fall. And seeing how the great dragon is the king of the children of pride, be careful lest you become one of his children. With all that being said, I encourage you to remember that those who think that they're able to resist the temptations of Satan, they ought to take heed with humility, lest we fall. If you think that you're strong enough, spiritually speaking, to in and of yourself stand against Satan, take heed. Take heed, lest you fall. Because, you know, much like Peter, Satan and his minions are looking to sift us like wheat. They're looking to bring us down. They're looking to play upon our pride so that we might become the children under the king of pride. Therefore, if you think that you're strong enough to stand against the spiritual attacks of Satan, take heed lest you fall. I like the way that James put it in the fourth chapter of his epistle. It's there where he declares, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. What's the order? Humble yourself, submit to God, then resist the devil. James says, draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your heart, you double-minded. Lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning, and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up. Leviathan flies up to the tops of the mountains and you know, presents his prideful ways, looking down on everything. And that's exactly what Satan wants us to do, is to stumble over our own foolish pride. The Lord says, humble yourself. Submit to God in that humility. And then he will give you the strength that we need to resist Satan. Listen, rather than trying to fight the great dragon in the finite strength of our fallen flesh, we should humbly submit to our Savior Jesus, so that by faith in Jesus Christ, we can then stand against the evil schemes of Satan. And as we humble ourselves before our Creator, he will enable us to resist the devil. And he'll do this according to the infinite power of the Holy Spirit who dwells within those who trust in Jesus Christ. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for your word.